Yeah, everybody. This is Kyler Bingham with Salt Lake Dirt. Very excited to talk to an author today. A book from a genre that I don't read a ton of, but I really found myself enjoying this one. Adam Roberts is here today to talk about the book, The Death of Sir Martin Malprelate. Hopefully I said that correctly.
That sounds good, man.
Adam, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me, Kyler. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, I don't read a ton of, well, I haven't read a ton of like 19th century works, and I know you're a professor of 19th century literature, lecturer. I was kind of blown away by the amount of books that you've written too. You're pretty prolific.
It's too many, really. That's what we can. Of the making of many books, there is no end. There are enough books in the world. I don't need to keep adding to them. I love writing books. What can I tell you? It's true. I've written a lot.
Oh, that's incredible. So let's talk about this book specifically. I really found fascinating how you were, from my perspective, reading it. It is like, in a way, reading this classical literature, but also modernized in the sense that it kept my attention and it was really fascinating. And then plus it was really fun, like all the different characters that were thrown in, from literature that you obviously are very familiar with. I'm talking like Dickens, and then Sherlock Holmes's father, I believe, is in it. So there's some really cool elements that I found, even for like a layperson like me, who's not super familiar. I was familiar enough that I, of course, understood the references, and it was very, very fun read. So talk to me about the genesis of the book. How did the idea come to you? And then just maybe kind of the process that you took in writing this particular book.
I mean, I'm glad that you enjoyed it. That's really heartening to hear, but you're right. So it's kind of a crime novel, and that's not usually what I write. So I have published I've published 22, I think, novels, and they're all but one, those science fiction novels. Science fiction is my great kind of love and passion. The publisher, Detura, is a new imprint that they've set up out of a publisher called Angry Robot, who specialize in science fiction. So I kind of know them through science fiction. And they were looking for crime titles to start a crime imprint. So the idea for this, which it kind of crosses over a little bit into science fiction, because that gets into everything that I, every way I think about the world, science fiction kind of creeps in at the edges. But I am also, as you say, a kind of academic who specializes in the 19th century Victorian literature and romantic poetry and the novels of Dickens and George Eliot. And as you say, at the end, there's a little bit of Sherlock Holmes comes in as well. So the premise was a version of the world where all the famous 19th century stories and all the literature and the books of the Victorian period are kind of all true and all coexistent. So that George Eliot's Middlemarch is a real town, and that characters from Dickens walk about the streets of London and meet characters from other Victorian writers. And that, I just like that idea. That's a kind of, because I love all that literature so much, and mixing them all in together seemed really cool. And so I came up with a crime story premise, which is this industrialist, Sir Martin Malprelate or Malprelate. Your guess is as good as mine as to how he pronounces his name. It's slightly, kind of wicked Victorian millionaire who's knocking down houses to build railway lines in 1848 is when it's set, which is a really interesting year in British 19th century history as well. And that kind of intrigued me to write a story set in that year. And he's murdered, but he's murdered in this bizarre way where he's sort of knocked down by a kind of spectral phantom hell locomotive that comes out of nowhere and then disappears into nowhere. And so there's a question there as to whether this is indeed a sort of supernatural kind of ghost story, or if something else it could be explained away, as happens in like a Scooby-Doo episode, that it turns out that there's some plot working behind the scenes. And then it's kind of I'm not used to doing it, so it's kind of fun to write a crime story, a kind of whodunit story, because you've got to think in terms of the puzzle element to it. You've got to think it's got to be a mystery that engages the reader, and it's got to be one where the reader there's a very particular kind of point you want to get to when you reveal the solution to the mystery. You want your reader, you don't want the reader to go, oh, that's random, that's nonsense, I could never see that coming. But you also don't want the reader to guess it, because then it just becomes, oh, that's too obvious, that's too easy. It's a sweet spot in between the two where the reader, you want the reader to go, ah, I see, that makes sense, that's clever, yeah, no, that's good.
Yeah.
You've got to layer the mystery and put the, you know, possible solutions, and so that the reader can work through on what's going on here. So, yeah, so I it didn't take me very long to write, because I really got caught up in it, and I was able to draw on all the stuff I know from my academic background about the 19th century. And one thing I will say, the interesting thing about that year, 1848, is that it's called the Year of Revolutions. And all across Europe, every single country in Europe had a revolution in 1848.
Oh, wow.
And this is before Germany was a unified nation. So all the little individual German states, they all had little individual revolutions. Really? The same in Italy, there was a big revolution in France and in Spain. The only country that didn't have a revolution was Britain. And it's a puzzle. No one knows how Britain avoided it, because the 1840s were a period of incredible misery. They called them the Hungry 40s. Harvests had failed and bread prices were very high and people were dying of starvation. And there was the famine in Ireland that led to so many people emigrating and moving to the States. It was a very bad time. And yet somehow Britain avoided having a revolution in 1848. So that's also part of the story.
Yeah.
And it all kind of, hopefully it all folds in together into a single kind of unified piece.
Yeah, no.
The Victorian period is not really your thing. You know, so you don't read so much in that.
Not that I'm not interested in it. I think it never grasped me when I was younger. And then it honestly, it kind of overwhelmed me. So I didn't know where. I always ask writers, like I've had a couple of poets on, and I've asked them like, well, where do I start? And this one guy had always stood out to me. He's like, you find something that interests you. There's no one place to start necessarily. Find something that interests you and start with that, and then just go there and don't put so much pressure on it. So I'm like, yeah. So same thing could apply to, works like this. So it's like reading this was kind of cool, because I thought it's a perfect book to introduce someone like myself who's not familiar with it, and to be like, oh, now I'm kind of like curious to go and read stuff from the past and maybe view it as just like enjoying it and jumping into it that way. So that's kind of how it's like a gateway into older books that I have maybe been intimidated with in the past. Yeah. So yeah, I should ask you though.
I mean, it's a thing. It's a kind of cliche in a way, but these are classic novels, but they're classic novels for a reason.
Right.
And the reason is they're really, really good. You know, the classic period Dickens from the 1840s and 50s, George Eliot's Middlemarch is one of the greatest novels ever written. And once you get past you're right, there can be something a bit musty and perhaps a bit off-putting about the thought, oh, it's some ancient old book, but they're immensely absorbing and kind of wonderful pieces of writing. Not that my book is in that league, but I was able to piggyback on some of them.
No, like I have a lot of those books. Like I have Middlemarch. I just bought it last year. It's on my bookshelf behind me. So it's waiting for me. I should ask you though. Like, when did you initially become interested in this time period of literature? You know, enough to devote your career to it. How did you initially become interested in it?
So, I mean, it's a story. I'll try not to spool it out at too great a length, because I do think about this. And these are the two kind of sides to me. So when I was a kid, I read science fiction kind of obsessively, and I still do. I still love science fiction, all that kind of golden age, you know, American science fiction, the space exploration. And I think that's what it is about science fiction, is that it has that imaginative expansiveness. It has that sense of wonder. It's can be mind-blowing and kind of wondrous. And you've got the whole universe as a kind of playground to have the adventures in and read stories about. And that was all I read, and I wasn't very kind of literary. And then I remember I was given a collection of a big art book as a Christmas present. And one of the images in that art book was a painting by John Millais, the Victorian painter, called Mariana, which is a woman in a blue velvet dress at an alcove in an old house, standing up and stretching because she's been embroidering. And it's based on a poem, and the poem is written by Alfred Tennyson called Mariana in the Moated Grange, about this mournful woman who's trapped in this house. And I was curious about the poem behind the painting, so I read the poem, and the poem just was so beautiful. It was so powerful. It made me think, oh, this is amazing. And it was giving me, the poetry was giving me something of that kind of transport that I still get out of science fiction, a kind of sense of wonder, a sense of being taken somewhere kind of new and fantastic. Mm-hmm. So then I read a whole bunch of Tennyson, and I kind of fell in love with Victorian poetry and pre-Raphaelite art. And you can see, I think, a crossover. A lot of fantasy art is basically pre-Raphaelite art. The kind of old Victorian medievalism informs a lot of fantasy writing as well. So then I just got very interested in the Victorian period. And when I went to university and then I did a PhD, at that point, we're talking in the early 1990s, it wouldn't have been viable to get a job at a university teaching science fiction. That was infradig. That was kind of below, that wasn't proper literature. But I could apply to university saying, oh, I can teach Romantic and Victorian literature. And that's what I got a job doing. So I've carried on doing that. But I've never abandoned the science fiction thing. And it's one of the nice things about writing Martin Malprelate is that, oh, there's a third way of pronouncing his name. There could be an endless number of ways of pronouncing his name. But one of the nice things about writing it was able to bring those two things together. Because another, I think, great Victorian writer from the end of the century is H.G. Wells. I mean, H.G. Wells was writing into the 20th century. He didn't die till 1945. Mm-hmm. But his great kind of decade in the 1890s, when he writes The Time Machine and The War of the Worlds and The Invisible Man and The Island of Dr. Moreau and these kind of great late science fiction masterpieces, they are very Victorian. We think of the steampunk, which is a kind of current vogue for Victorian 19th century science fiction. This all kind of goes back to H.G. Wells. So then I thought, well, is there a way I could put some of H.G. Wells's fictional characters into my story? And I can't, because they're from the 1890s and this is set in 1848. But on the other hand, one of these characters has a time machine. So then you think, well, there's possibilities that kind of open up.
Oh, that's, I love that. Now, you know, so we talked about, you have so many books. Like I admire that. Like that's such a cool thing. So to me, I'm always curious. Even just putting one book out is a challenge. You know. So how have you been able to balance, like, you know, your career, your life, but then also putting out like so many books? Like how do you do that? It's amazing to me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a boring answer to that, which is just I write every day. I write all the time, and I have to say, I think one of the things that changed in my life is when my wife and I had kids. So my eldest is 22 now, and my son is 15. I don't know what I did with my time before we had kids. I must have had acres, deserts, empty time. I don't know. I sat on my hands or stared at the wall. I wasn't very productive. Then you have kids, and suddenly every kind of half hour that you can snatch away from kind of ever present doing the job and raising the kids becomes this kind of precious thing that you don't want to let it go. So every opportunity I get, I'll do a bit of writing. I think the truth, Kyla, is I'm a writer because in the first place, because I love reading. Mm-hmm. And I love reading books, and I still love reading books. And writing books is like reading books, only more so. It's kind of more immersive. And that's when I'm happiest, is when I start and I'm writing something and I get completely absorbed in it. The rest of the process, it's fine when you have to go and you have to go back and you have to revise what you've written, and you have to, change it and adapt it, and then you have to send it to the publishers, and then it comes back and you have edits and you get proofs, you have to read the proofs, then it gets released and goes into bookshops. All that's fine, and mm-hmm. it's great talking to you here today, for instance. But the real joy for me is just in that initial process of writing it down, because it's so kind of, and because I love doing it, I do it a lot.
Yeah.
And I tell you something H.G. Wells said, actually. I wrote a biography of H.G. Wells. It's one of the books I previously done. He was also a very prolific author. He wrote two or three books a year, all the way through from 1890 to 1945. There's a lot of books. And people said to him, well, how are you so prolific? And his answer was, well, I'm an indolent man. I'm quite lazy and I'm sitting down anyway. So I might as well write something. That's kind of where I am.
Very, very modest, very humble, but like still, I'm very impressed. Now, so with this book, like you mentioned, like all the, like the twists and turns, and then having, you know, the ending, of course, that we will not spoil, of course. But when you're writing something like this, when you found that sweet spot, so, you know, something that is surprising and not obvious, but also believable in a sense, with this particular project, did you have that answer in your mind from the beginning, or did you discover it as you wrote?
And that's a really good question, because I speak to other writers, and I know writers who work in crime, and I say it's not really my genre, but I know people who do that. And it seems to me that there are two kinds of crime writers. There are those who start off with like a mystery, mm-hmm. and they write it out, and then they have to somehow kind of work out what the mystery is as they're going along. And then there are others who carefully plan everything from the ending back to the beginning so that everything kind of falls into place. In my case, I'm more used to doing the first of those two than the second. That I'll start writing one of my regular science fiction novels with an imagined world and a premise and an idea, and I'll develop it and see where it goes. But that can be a problem, I think, when you're doing a whodunit, mm-hmm. because you can't just write a whodunit and then do eeny, meeny, miny, moe and pick one of the characters and say, you're the murderer. Particularly in this particular story, and you're right, I don't want to spoil it for anyone who might conceivably read it. There might be three or maybe even four people in the United States who want to read this book, and I don't want to pull them off by giving the ending away. But there was something kind of baked into the initial premise where it wasn't just, oh, wow, here's a phantom locomotive from hell that's run over this industrialist. I had to have an understanding of how that might happen. So I'm not really answering your question. I kind of compromised between the two.
Yeah.
There were elements of the story that really only came clear as I had written a first draft, as I was writing it out. And I do think, in a broader sense, the process of writing, again, writers I know who plan every single chapter, every step in the story in advance, and sometimes have a huge spreadsheet and then just write it out. Mm-hmm. And I've tried doing that. And what I think happens is I get bored in the writing because it's all already kind of laid out. And I think that boredom can communicate itself to the reader. On the other hand, doing it entirely seat of the pants, where you just launch yourself and let's see where we go, that I think in my case can lead to a kind of ill-disciplined kind of sprawl. So what I generally do when I write a novel, any kind of novel, including this one, is I know where I'm starting, I know where I want to end up, and I know kind of key points I want to hit on the way. Mm-hmm. But then I give myself enough freedom to write my way from stage to stage. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does. You know, it's interesting because I've talked to a lot of writers, and I, you know, especially with like a complex plot and a lot of twists and turns, I always tend to ask that question. And the books that I've enjoyed the most, the authors say a very similar thing, where they may have a few points kind of like, but they don't have every little thing outlined because it does get stale for them. And, you know, that works for different authors. That's awesome. But I've noticed I tend to gravitate towards the writers who kind of do a combination of it. And one thing I found really interesting was, so let's talk about the Sir Martin himself. I just found his character very fascinating. That like not a super likable individual, but he did love animals. So I thought that was
he loves animals.
He loves animals. I thought it was so cool. And I, you know, clearly you wrote the book effectively because, you know, when you care about a character who is kind of like you don't really like him in a lot of ways, you care, like you want to know what happened. So I guess I'd love you to talk about this character specifically, and just kind of like where he came from, and how you fleshed him out. So you did, you know, you made him a real person. So it really became a fascinating a character study to me, particularly the fact that he loved animals. I just thought that was a really cool element of his personality.
I wonder if it's a British thing, or even maybe just an English thing, that I know lots of people who, English people who adore animals and don't like people very much. It's a kind of, you know, they love their pets and they, well, they keep horses and horses are wonderful to them, and other human beings, that's different.
Not so much.
Yeah. I mean, it's partly a reflection on 19th century literature, Victorian literature, because the Victorian age was the great age of expansion in British history. And this is when the Industrial Revolution happened, and we went from being, you know, a kind of small island nation off the shoulder of Europe to being this economic superpower and having a world empire. And it's kind of triumph, really, of enterprise and capitalism. And yet, when you read Victorian novels, people who run business, people who are industrialists or financiers, are always villains. There are no kind of hero characters. There's no one, there's no sense in Victorian literature. And if you read Dickens or Thackeray or whoever, there's no sense that, or Trollope, there's no sense that these are people to be admired or who have done, you know, powerhouses of the economy or doing good. And often these people, you know, were not only very wealthy businessmen who made fortunes, but like Andrew Carnegie, let's say, who was born as a poor Scottish lad in the 19th century and made an absolutely enormous fortune for himself, and then became an absolutely enormous benefactor and founded Carnegie Hall and Carnegie Scholarships and gave all his money away for good. You might think such a character would be a kind of hero, but no, Victorian literature looks all without exception. It's a very strange thing. I can't think of a single virtuous kind of capitalist character in the whole of Victorian fiction. They're always bad. They're always villains. There's something exploitative about them. And that's kind of the sense we have of them, walking around in their stovepipe hats and exploiting workers and knocking down people's houses and extracting rent. Or Scrooge in The Christmas Carol. I mean, we're just after Christmas here, aren't we? So Scrooge is kind of a moneylender and a financier and an investor in the stock market, but he's ruthless and squeezing, and he has to be redeemed from being that kind of a person by the visits of the ghosts. And that interests me as well. So I didn't make Mal Prelate a kind of nice person, and he is quite ruthless in the way that he has pursued his, and I suppose that I think is also true. I don't think you get to be a multi-millionaire by being nice to people.
Right.
You don't start as a benefactor giving all your money away. Otherwise, you'd never accumulate your fortune in the first place. But he does have this, I think, redeeming quality, which is that he does love animals. Mm. And he's living in an age when a lot of animals suffered very badly. So there's a whole story about the development of London Zoo, which I have researched and read up on, which is very interesting, in Regent's Park, just in the north and west bit of central London, which was positioned on the prime land, which would have made for a very handy direct rail line out of London up to Birmingham and the big industrial towns in the northwest, but which is still a major world zoo. It's a large piece of prime London real estate. And so that's also part of kind of the story.
Yeah, I think I love the title, just, you know, because it just tells you exactly what it is. So it isn't like, you know, it's the death of a person. And that's what initially just like grasped me, like that pulled me in to want to read it. The name itself, like, how did you come up with his name? I mean, is that kind of a silly question? But I just, like, the name was, and it just, what I found interesting was, I didn't have trouble remembering the title. Like, if I was telling someone about it, I'm reading this book, The Death of Sir Martin Malprelate, it just kind of, like, it just rolled off the tongue. So the name itself, I found very cool. How did that come to you? I'm just very interested in that.
I mean, that's a kind of footnote. There was in the 16th century in England, when the Puritans were in power, actually a little before the Puritans came to power with the Cromwell and the English Revolution, there was a Puritan writer who published a series of tracts under the pseudonym Martin Malprelate, which attacked the Church of England. And he had to do it under a pseudonym because if he'd done it under his own name, he'd have been thrown in prison. And that, you know, Malprelate, I suppose, is a way of saying bad priest, isn't it? It's about somebody. That's where the Puritans thought we should reform the Church of England, and it was full of corrupt vicars and bishops and what have you. And that's where the name came from. And I it's not that I'm an expert on that field, but it is just a very cool name.
Yeah.
And it is nice to kind of appropriate that. When you're a writer, you do that. You notice. And I teach a bit of creative writing at the university. That's one of the things I do, in addition to the Romantic and Victorian stuff. And there's a couple of hints and tricks. So you always carry a notebook. You're sitting on the train or on the bus and you overhear conversation. You write it down straight away. You'll never quite get the exact phrase that is so wonderful if you try and remember it after the fact. Mm-hmm. Keep a notebook by your bed. If you wake up and you've had a brilliant idea, never say, oh, that's great, I'll go back to sleep and I'll remember that in the morning. You won't remember in the morning. You write it down straight away. But also when you notice something, when a name, street name or a name anywhere strikes you, make a note of it. It just seems really good. I mean, Malprelate, it's kind of antiquated, isn't it? Also, and Mal, bad. You think he's a bad character. He's not as bad as you think he is. He's actually got his mission in a way, which is to save the animals, to preserve London Zoo and to... It's a great name, I think.
Yeah, it is. I know.
But I didn't invent it. No, so I kind of found it in this kind of 17th century set of religious tracts.
Yeah, that's so cool. His name lives on. That's incredible. I think, so I don't know how much you can talk about. You'd mentioned this other book that you're kind of putting the finishing touches on. Are you able to speak about that? Or we can always have you back on and talk about that. But
well, I'd be obviously very happy to come back on again. I mean, so the situation with that is I published, first of all, in 2006, I published A History of Science Fiction, because science fiction, I grew up reading science fiction. I'm still writing science fiction. I published that, and we did a second edition of that, a kind of updated edition in 2016. A History of Science Fiction, which covers everything from the beginnings of the genre right through the 19th century, a lot of it, Shelley's Frankenstein and Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and then into the kind of big boom of science fiction in the 20th century. And I enjoyed writing that, but that was easier to do than this current project, because I think I just was much more au fait. I was much more a better read in science fiction. But it seemed logical then to do a companion volume, A History of Fantasy, which I also love fantasy. And I grew up reading Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and Ursula Le Guin and the kind of great classic fantasy writers of the 50s and 60s. In fact, for a long time, I would reread Lord of the Rings every year.
Oh, wow.
I've read it first time, I think, when I was 12, and then I kind of reread it every year until I kind of fell out of the habit of doing that. But after the Peter Jackson movies came out at the beginning of the noughties, and the endless recirculation of Tolkien and other fantasy texts in the 21st century, fantasy's bigger now than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. So I signed a contract with Bloomsbury Books to write a history of fantasy. And we were talking about this earlier. It's just a different proposition. That some science fiction books are quite big, but a lot of pulp science fiction books are written at speed and they're 140 pages and you can read them quite easily. Fantasy, for some reason, has to be huge. It has to be 12 volume series and each volume is 1,000 pages. And that's just a lot of reading. And some of it is good and a lot of it isn't. And some of the stuff that's really very popular, you're reading it and you're thinking, how did this get to be so popular? This is very badly written and endless and prolix and nothing really happens. I've read volume 7 of this fantasy series and now we're no further towards the end of the story than we were at the beginning. Volume 7, I don't know what's going on. It's But I mean, yeah, it has been a journey, as they say. The contract is I'm supposed to give them the book by the end of this month. We're getting near the end of the month, and I'm trying to wrap it up as we speak. The hardest part actually is just keeping it within proper bounds, because on the one hand, a history of fantasy could be a history of absolutely everything. We could say, away, the default storytelling mode of humankind is fantasy. The Epic of Gilgamesh is a fantasy. Homer's Odyssey is a fantasy. Beowulf is a fantasy. You know, medieval romance is fantasy. The Faerie Queen, Milton's Paradise Lost, these are all kind of fantasies. There are realist stories and realist novels, and they're great, but they're a kind of small subset of human storytelling. Mostly the stories that people want to hear have kind of fantastical elements to them. Now, I couldn't write a history of absolutely everything, so I narrowed it down. So I'm starting in the late 19th century with Arthurian retellings of Arthurian legends and the William Morris's fantasy novels. And then in the 1920s and 30s, fantasy novels start getting written in greater numbers. And then it really picks up with Tolkien. Tolkien becomes a big campus hit in the 1960s, and then it becomes a global hit. And by the 80s and the 90s, fantasy really, really expands. So the hardest part to write is the 21st century chapter, which I'm just finishing up now, because there's just so much fantasy. It's not just novels, it's movies and TV series and video games, and it's fandoms, it's an AO3 fan writing and cosplay and conventions, and it's just enormous. It's just everywhere at the moment. And trying to squeeze that into a single chapter is proving a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, well,
I don't know if fantasy is your thing at all, if it's something you read much.
No, again, no, like I never read. I think I took I got disgruntled with the genre when I used to work in a bookstore in my early 20s, and the fantasy section like we didn't have enough space for it, so just like kind of trying to cram all the books in that they kept. We had the guy who would order the fantasy books. He was a huge fantasy reader, so we would have to get all these books onto the floor, and it was a nightmare. That was the one section that I hated. Stocking. So but I'm open to it now. So like that's why I'm excited. I'm excited to check out these books that you've put out, because maybe you can give me a starting point or just something. I can find something that interests me, and you know, be open myself up to a new genre that I haven't really looked at before.
And I think there's one of the arguments I'm making in the book has to do with, I don't want to get too kind of technical about it, but there's people talk about modernity, where we're living now, as a kind of disenchanted world, that science has taken lots of the magic out of the world, that we don't, you know, we no longer believe that the strange spirits lurking in the woods, or that monsters under our beds, or that we might be possessed by kind of strange forces. But you don't have to go back too far, and people did believe all that stuff. Mm-hmm. They lived in an enchanted world, a kind of pre-modern world. The medieval world was one that was full of enchantment, and it was full of wonder. It was full of a kind of magic that I think we have lost. It was also, I think, full of a kind of terror that we're sort of safe from. The Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor talks about how our secular life now, we live kind of buffered lives. Our minds are sort of buffered from all that terrifying supernatural stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't go back too far, and what he says is it used to be the case that our minds were porous and that we lived in wonder and terror. And I think there is an argument that fantasy provides a sort of safe version of that porous mindset. It takes us back, it re-enchants the world and makes the world more magical. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it starts really to take form after World War One, and lots of the key writers of fantasy were fought in the trenches. You know, they saw the horrors of industrialized modern warfare firsthand. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and Dunsany and various others, and that their reaction to that was to write stories that went back into an idealized history where warfare is kind of noble and chivalric and wonderful, and the world is magical and not mechanized and industrialized and drained of wonder, and that's kind of at the heart of it. And that's what I think a lot of people go to fantasy for that transport, for that re-enchantment.
Oh, that's so interesting. That does make me, I had never considered that before. That's really interesting. Well, yeah, I'm excited to check that out when it eventually is published. It sounds like, yeah, you have a couple more days.
And before, yeah, I've got it. What will be 28th of December? That's 3 days. I can write it in 3. How hard can it be?
How hard can it be? Well, this has been a real a treat, Adam. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me, man. I've really enjoyed this.
Absolutely. So everyone, again, Adam Roberts is the author, The Death of Sir Martin Malprelate.
That's good.
I keep saying different ways, but we'll have links to where you can pick up a copy. I've become a fan of Datura Books. They, everything, I've read I think 2 or 3 things from them, and I've really enjoyed them. So, everybody, keep your eye out.
I mean, obviously, it's not disinterested of me to say so, but it's not just my book. I think it's a really, the list they've launched with is really interesting. It's really varied. There's all sorts of different kinds of poem writing there.
Yeah.
And my book is not completely characteristic of mostly what they're doing, but it's, you know, it's good. I think it's going to be good. Yeah. Going forward.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what else they put out, but they've been incredible so far. So I'll have a link to them as well, everybody. I encourage you to check out their catalog. They have some great stuff. Again, like this has been wonderful, and love to have you on. I know the time difference is kind of challenging, but we made it work. I'm excited. Yeah. And I would love to have you back on in the future. If you will come back, that would be incredible to talk more. Maybe I can read some fantasy stuff in the meantime to.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd love to come back on, Carlo. Fantastic.
Wonderful. Thank you, Adam.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.